I've heard it said that if you talk about the same thing too much, then people lose interest. And but I'm going to give one more talk on this idea of self. And pretty much most of the last, I don't know, has it been 5 weeks now? This is the fifth week? Some of you keeping count. one talk after another, trying to, from different angles and different perspectives, on this Buddhist idea of self. I think it's an interesting one. As I keep saying, it's quite perplexing to many people because it seems that on the surface that Buddhism says that there is no self. And then, well, where does that leave you? And then some people, even teachers, will very seriously kind of almost pun on that and say, well, it leaves you nowhere. That's the point. To be left nowhere, left hanging or left nowhere to stand, nowhere to abide. And what I, one of the things I said last week is that according to the Buddha, that once you enter into the discussions, the discussion about self and no self, that you end up into a quagmire of metaphysical beliefs. And it's just a swamp. It gets more and more complicated the more you look at it. And he actually tried to offer something that was a lot simpler than the notions of self. And I don't know how well I succeeded in simplifying it for you or making it clear this whole teaching of the last few weeks. Some of you weren't here to get it. So, a little bit of what I'd like to do is to take it down a different angle, but also a little bit of a summary of the last weeks of what I've said, kind of an overview. Maybe putting it all together in one evening might make it some more different kind of sense out of it. So in Buddhist teachings, especially here in the West, there's a lot of teachings about this idea of self, and it's usually translating a Pali word, atta, A-T-T-A. In Sanskrit, the same word is atman, and in Pali, anatta is then the negative, and it's usually English translated as no self, but as I said last few weeks, it's better translated as not self. But still, it's this word atta in Pali, and it's the word usually self in English. There's a different word that is seldom talked about, especially in the West, that's related to the word atta. It's a kind of almost a synonym for self, but not quite the same. And that's the English word for person. And there's a Pali word and Sanskrit word, pugala. And there were, in fact, in ancient India, there's some evidence that the most popular form of Buddhism for many hundreds of years in India was not the kinds of Buddhism that survived down to present times, but it was a form of Buddhism that was called the Pugala Vadins, the teachings of the persons, the people who believed in this category called the Pugalas, persons. And so this idea of person then became an important category for these people, but it's also there in this tradition. So we have this English word person. And so what's the Buddhist teachings about personhood? And how is that, why bring this up as opposed to the teachings about self? I think there's a series of words which can be seen almost as synonyms in English, and also you find almost equivalents in some of the Buddhist languages. One is, sort of self, maybe translation of atta, person, translation of pugala. There is also the idea of the human being, a human. Another word is individual. So you're a self, you're a person, you're an individual, you're a human. And there's probably some other words like that. What I'd like to suggest here this evening is that there's nuances and difference between these words. Human being is a large general category that all human beings fit into. Sorry. human beings are human beings. It's just a big category. The word individual might not refer to human beings, but as a human, talking about human beings, an individual, seems like it would be the same thing. However, the word individual is a word that is in relationship to something else, which is maybe a society or a social being, social relationships. And in fact, individual and individuation and individualism are relatively modern words. Some of them are only a few decades old, some are a few centuries old. And in some countries and some societies, cultures in the world, the word individual, it doesn't have the same meaning or value as it does, or it doesn't exist kind of the same way as it exists for us here in America, where the word individual is very, very important. Where individual, in contrast to being somehow merged with society, we stand out, we're unique. Individual points to our uniqueness, in America. And so we individuate, means we differentiate ourselves from others. So the word individual implies differentiation. The word human doesn't imply differentiation, it just means that you're part of this class of the species, right? This class of beings that are called human beings. The word self, I'm not sure exactly how it falls. Maybe these are all words, it's semantics, so you might have different uses of the word. But the word self is a cherished idea. I can say that safely, can't I? It's so cherished that if we say there is no self, then there's always someone who protests and complains, and it's especially if you're in therapy or are a therapist, it's pretty inevitable that someone will raise their hand and say, "Wait a minute, this is a cherished idea in my therapy. I'm trying to develop a strong sense of self, and here you're telling me there's no self, and that just doesn't something has to give." It doesn't make sense, maybe. So then, but I would like to suggest that the word self implies something either very individual, very unique, something unique within us. The inner self, for example. Find yourself almost means the same thing as go inside and discover who you are. Where if you say find out who you are, what you are as a human being, we don't necessarily do the same thing. We go inner to our inner psychological life. And sometimes the word self then kind of morphs into something very universal, like the cosmic self, the big self, the little bit like Hindu idea of Atman and the ultimate in the world being the same. But so the self has that kind of connotations, I think, the inner psychological self or the soul or something. The word person, I'd like to suggest, has a different connotation. The word person is kind of a hybrid concept that covers both the universal aspect of being a human being, but also something that's very particular to each person, to each being. It's kind of both kind of a little bit universal and personal. It's both unique and kind of general. So, so every culture and every religion has some understanding of what it means to be a person. That I would suggest is different than their understanding of what it means to be a self or a not self or a no self. It's just kind of the way they understand what does it mean to be a human being. When you look at a human being, the purpose of being a human being, the goal of a human being, the condition of a human being, every culture, every religion has some notion of a person. So in Buddhism also, there is this notion of what it means to be a person. You can ask of Buddhists, what's the Buddhist concept of personhood? And that's a very different kind of way of looking at us and ourselves than asking the question, what is myself? What is the self? The self is kind of, in that kind of context, I'd like to suggest that looking for the self can be seen as a narrowing of the question to something essential. We're saying, what is it to be what is it to be a person? Brings in a whole ecology of a human being that is much more broader. So each religion, I would venture to say here, has a concept of personhood. So, what is the concept of the Buddha? What's the Buddhist concept of personhood? How do we understand what it means to be a human being? And once you start making statements, something seemingly very innocent and simple statements of what it means to be a person, or you read between the lines and say, well, this is what they mean. This is how they see what a human being is all about. Then a simple statement actually can build a huge, complex philosophy, metaphysics, culture. It builds out of that. So you have, for example, religious and cultural ideas of innate human evil, sin. And you have ideas of innate human goodness. And that's kind of a view. This is what a person is somehow. That human beings, as a person, we have this innate quality. And then from that very simple statement, then that implies and implies and implies. And you have something that develops from that. So I'm going to offer 6 different points of how early Buddhism, the Buddhism that we kind of follow here at IMC, how it understands the human person as distinct from what the self is. Are you following me enough? Is this interesting enough? You're still here. You've been patient all these weeks. So, one of the concepts of a human person that's central for this tradition is that a human being, a human person, is subject to suffering and to happiness. It's a something, it's a being, it's an entity which is subject to suffering and to happiness, to disintegration and integration, to bondage and to freedom. That's inherent in the understanding of a human person. So when the Buddha looks at a human being, the Buddha sees a being, an entity that has this potential or this capacity, or subject to these things. The second point is that the human being, or our person who we are, is a moral agent. Not necessarily moral in terms of moralistic, but is an agent of change. We can make choices to change ourselves, to change the world. We're agents of change. That we're not only victims or subjects to the whims of reality in the world, but that human beings also can act in the world, on the world, and on ourselves. That we're agents of action. And there are religious teachings in the world that claim that human beings are not actors. We can't act, we can't make a change, it's all an illusion, is one idea. And you shouldn't even bother. The important things in life are not up to you. It's fate, it's destiny, it's up to the gods, it's predetermined, there is no free will. So in the second point, it's related to the idea that there is a kind of free will in Buddhism. There's choice that we make, and that human beings can be the agents for change, for action, for effect. We can affect the world. And what we do makes a difference. The things we do, the ways we act, the choices we make, do make a difference in the world. They have an effect. And then following that into point 3, is that human beings can change and develop and grow over time, just like a child can grow as they get older. And that growth and development of a human being is not necessarily all for the better. There are people who grow and develop and make choices and are influenced by the conditions around them in such a way that they become forces of harm in the world. They harm other beings. They harm others. And they get really good at it. They develop a tremendous capacity to be murderers, killers, all kinds of things. Even sometimes when we don't even want it, the choices we make, the way we live our life, lends itself to accidents that wouldn't happen if we left the quail alone.
Thank you.
So we can develop and grow, but that development and growth then isn't necessarily always beneficial, but it can be beneficial. And so there's beneficial ways we can grow and develop, and that ability to grow and develop in beneficial ways is related to two things. One is that we know what's beneficial, so we know what to work towards. And that we act in the world, or we behave in such a way that we allow that growth and development to happen. So we're human beings are the Buddhist understanding of a person is a person is someone who can grow and develop. Then related to all these points, another point, which is that we are all subject to cause and effect, sometimes called karma. That it's related to what I said earlier, but rather than focusing on human beings as being the agent, we're also the subject of our actions. So we can act in the world, but depending how we act in the world, it comes back to us in some way or other. And if we're the recipients of the effect of our actions. Not all effects, not in some mechanical way where it's obvious. But there's some way or other which things come back to us. And so it's the notion of karma, the habits we develop, the conditions we set in motion in our mind that will come back and bite us if they're bad conditions, or help us if they're good ones. But we're the result, you know, our karma comes back and affects us. And therefore, related to all this now is the fifth point, is that that there are worthwhile goals for human being. There are worthwhile things to strive for or to work towards. And sometimes you have religious teachings that say that you're perfect just the way you are. The thing to do is just relax, have it easy, accept yourself as being but not just innately beautiful and great. And there's nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to be, all these kinds of teachings. Maybe even I've said things like that here, and maybe other teachers, Buddhist teachers, have said that even. There's a book titled, you know, Nowhere to Go, Nowhere to Go, Nothing to Be. But, you know, it's one of the things you should always be suspicious of spiritual teachers. Always. You shouldn't let any of them off the hook. And I would like to suggest that spiritual teachings also exist not in a vacuum, but they exist part of a larger package of culture, of society, of conditions, and then affect how we see the human person. So I'll offer you one challenging premise, that the teachings of that we're all perfect, just fine the way we are, it's just a matter of relaxing and opening, nowhere to go, nothing to be, tends to be most popular in the history of Buddhism in relatively affluent cultures, societies, groups. Now, why is that? Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become, nothing to attain, just enjoy. So that's interesting. It might be very profound, it might be very true teachings, but why are those teachings most popular in particular societies and not in others? So there's this idea when the Buddha looks at a human being that this is probably the place where in these premises that seem to me like the biggest leap. Where's the manual that says this is what a human being should be like? Why should this be so? So the Buddha, in the views of the Buddha, there is a goal which is worthwhile to pursue. Or actually two goals. It's worthwhile to pursue the goal of happiness, and it's worthwhile to pursue the goal of liberation for human beings. So for the individual, and for other individuals. So the Buddha dedicated most of his life to try to bring that message out of his compassion and care for others, to bring that message of possibility and encourage people and show people a path that people could follow and walk so they could develop themselves, create the conditions, be the agents of change, so that they could make a difference in this human capacity to suffer or to be happy, to be in bondage or to be liberated. So there is a worthwhile purpose or goal for human being, and the primary one, the ultimate one, is liberation. Liberation is a worthwhile goal. Also, when the Buddha sees a human being, he sees that liberation is a potential that all human beings have. Whether they have a self or do not have a self, liberation is a possibility for all beings. So a human person, understanding a human person, has that. Some people would like to see that as being an innate quality, the Buddha nature in each person, the innate goodness in a person. But I don't know if a potential is the same thing as something inherent. Potential is kind of a strange category. And this whole idea is, are human beings inherently good? Are human beings inherently bad? The Buddha avoids that kind of question. It's not really addressed. It's not really maybe interesting kind of question. If anything, how the Buddha sees it is that inherent in human beings, inherent in unliberated human beings, is they have the capacity for both evil and for good. So in terms of the capacity, potential, that we have inherent in all of us is both good and evil. It depends on what we feed, what we act on, how we live our lives, which gets stronger. So I think the Buddha is reluctant to say, you know, people are inherently good or inherently bad. It's just that question is not answered by the Buddha. I think the answer is we're both, depending on what direction we choose to go. But anyway, liberation is a potential we all have. And then related to this is that the Buddha doesn't say this, you know, explicitly, but I think implicit in his teaching, close to being explicit, is a notion that we should respect this potential in other people. That other people, besides ourselves, have all these potential for happiness and for suffering, for bondage and liberation, and that we should respect that in other people and not interfere with their happiness and liberation. In fact, we should not only shouldn't we interfere, but it's actually good to help it, be supportive of it. So that then feeds into Buddhist ideas about things like euthanasia and maybe even abortion. In order to look at these questions of what to do over these life and death questions, existential questions, you have to answer some questions about, well, how do you understand what a human being is like, what a person is? And so if you understand the human being has this potential for liberation, and that this is a valuable potential to respect and to honor, then some Buddhists will make certain decisions around questions of life and death based on their respect and valuing of that potential and letting that potential unfold the best possible. Then the last point that is also, I think is interesting. In this early Buddhist tradition, the teachings of the Buddha, when the Buddha looks at human beings and understanding personhood or person, the Buddha differentiates between different kinds of people, different types of persons. So rather than seeing that everybody's equal, everybody's the same, and there's no difference between all of us, the Buddha actually differentiates between people. Now, it's not so strange to say that because we do that. If you want to, if you have something that requires surgery, you know, you don't go out and ask your mechanic to do it. Mm. Right? You differentiate between your car mechanic and your surgeon. That's an important distinction to make. And usually. And so in the spiritual life, the Buddha makes distinctions, differentiates. And I find myself feeling inside, I feel shy about making distinctions between people on a spiritual basis. Just somehow it feels kind of wrong to do that. And sometimes I kind of lean against kind of want to kind of avoid that kind of Buddhism. And when I translated Dhammapada, there was all these places where the Buddha was differentiating between people in ways that made me a little bit uncomfortable. Like, for example, some people are fools. You know, when's the last time you heard me sitting up here? Some of you have been coming here for years and years. And, you know, I said, have I ever referred to somebody as being foolish? Someone such kind of person is foolish? You know, maybe I should. Starting with myself. But the Buddha differentiates between fools and wise people. Some people are wise and some people are foolish. And it's not inherent in who we are, but rather it's something, it has to do with our choices we make and how we develop ourselves. So some people make foolish choices and some people make wise choices. And that's a useful distinction, apparently, because the Buddha made it a lot. The other differentiation or different kinds of people is people is big one is people who have been liberated and the people who have not. And there's a lot of language acknowledging certain people as being liberated in contrast to people who are not. The most common one is the word arhat, which literally translates as the word worthy. It's someone who's worthy. Worthy of respect, worthy of, since most of them are monks, it's also meant they're worthy of our generosity, of our gifts, of our giving them food. The other word is that arya, which means usually translated to English as noble. These are people who are noble. They have attained a certain degree of nobility. Sometimes the Buddha referred to people who had attained liberation as Brahmins, attained a certain level of inner purity as Brahmins. And very clearly undermining the idea in his times that the caste Brahmins was something you were born into. So the idea that you were born into a caste, but your status as a human being was dependent on how you were born, was something the Buddha just wiped away. So that your status was based on your birth, you know, who you were born to, your ethnicity, your race, your financial situation, you know, all kinds of other kind of worldly kind of ways of measuring a person, the Buddha just wiped away. And the differentiation that was left for him was differentiation between, have you done the inner work of purification? So have you somehow or other become pure? And purity, becoming pure, is the same thing as becoming liberated. Because the forces of impurity that are being cleansed are the forces of greed, hate, and delusion. The forces of clinging and grasping. So a human being is someone who can... So there are differences between people. And even though it makes us uncomfortable and then there's all this competition and status making and a lot of ugly things happen when we make those distinctions, But anyway, he made it, and maybe there's something to be looked at with it rather than ignoring it because it's ugly. Not ugly inherent, because people hold it in ugly ways. This is a distinction the Buddha put a lot of value on because he makes it a lot. And to go back to the mechanic surgeon kind of distinction, it does make some sense that if you're going to learn a spiritual path from someone, you want to have some confidence that they have been on that path, or they're further along on that path than you, or they have reached some level of attainment or liberation or some degree of purification or change, something. Whether it's having confidence in the Buddha and his teachings, or whether it's having confidence, some kind of confidence in a teacher that you listen to, like some of you come here to me, listen to me. You know, there's probably some differentiation going on in your own minds that you come here and not, you can do other things with your Monday evenings. So in looking at suffering, since that's kind of the core issue in Buddhism, suffering and freedom from suffering. So in looking at suffering, there are three forms of suffering. There's one form of suffering, one cause of suffering that's really big for human beings. For a lot of human beings. And that is suffering around self-image self-evaluation, self-possessions, our personal possessions. Those are really big. So one evening I talked about those three. The clinging to possessions, this is my possession. The clinging to self-evaluation, conceit. And the clinging to some view or idea, this is who I am, some image, this is who I really am, essentially am. That there's this activity called selfing. The activity of making a self, creating a self, positing a self, and then orienting oneself to that self, which tends to cause a lot of suffering for human beings. So we haven't said anything about there is or not a self, but there is a lot of activity in human beings around selfing, around making themselves, holding on to self-image, protecting it, defending it. A lot of emphasis on evaluating oneself. Am I good enough? Am I not good enough? My self-esteem, my self-worth. How am I compared to others? You know, all these things. And then my possession, things that are mine. This is really who I am. Having these possessions defines who I am. So I think that's going to be pretty given, right? That there's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of suffering around selfing. There's probably selfing that maybe doesn't cause, maybe there's selfing doesn't cause suffering, but there is a lot of suffering that comes out of selfing. So if we're going to address the issue of suffering and find liberation from suffering, find happiness, somehow it has to address the activity of selfing. And the primary thing it has to do is to somehow free us from being neurotically preoccupied with selfing, with self-evaluation, with concerned with my possessions and my things, and concerned with some, even being concerned with some kind of essentialist idea of this is who I really am. This is my true self, which can also be something we hold on to. And sometimes we don't even see it until it's taken away. And sometimes there are health things that happen, or accidents that happen, or disasters that happen, where the way that we've understood who we really are, maybe in its unconscious way, is not available anymore. It's taken away from us. Someone is young and very athletic, and their whole life has to do with being active and involved athletically in the world, and they have some serious injury, and they can no longer do that. And they don't even know who they are. They have no idea who they are. They have no idea of how to be in the world, because their whole life was oriented around that particular persona, that particular image of who they were. And that's taken away, and they have to kind of, it's very painful. They didn't know how much they were attached to it. What's a little bit harder to understand, maybe, is the way that some metaphysical idea of self can also cause suffering. And the metaphysical idea of self sometimes is maybe better translated into English as soul rather than self. Some idea of this is my soul. The Buddha suggested that even that can cause suffering. That can lead to all kinds of problems. So don't even bother with the whole pursuit of the soul, thinking about the soul, or thinking about the true self, the essential self. Just let that all fall away. It's not needed to address it. What is needed was the Buddha offered a very simple path, simple in principle. And that is, rather than kind of looking at your life through the filter or the lens of self, of soul, of self-image or self-evaluation, look at your life through the filter of suffering and the freedom from suffering, from stress and the ending of stress, from tension and the release of tension. Now it turns out that a lot of the selfing we do has tension, stress, and suffering as part of it. Not only as a result of it, but in the very creation of it. We don't necessarily evaluate ourselves or hold on to the strong sense of self unless there's already suffering there to begin with. We feel uncomfortable somehow, and then we latch onto some self-identity, some self-image, to create a protective image for us that will kind of make us feel better. And so even the idea of creating the idea of the essential self, the soul, having those ideas, if you pay very, very careful attention, you might see the strain or the stress or the tension that's even going on in the mind, in the psyche, with that kind of preoccupation and concern. So if you use suffering or stress or tension as the reference point, kind of sniff it out, get really sensitive to it, then all these other issues will become clear. They'll come to you. But rather than resolving them metaphysically or philosophically, you resolve the tension. You relax it. Before getting a PhD in philosophy, you just relax. So some people want to know, what's the meaning of life? It's a great one, right? What's the meaning of life? What's the true meaning of life? It's an interesting question. An interesting answer is, before we answer that question, let's find out why you're asking it. And is there suffering prompting you to ask that question? And if there is suffering prompting you to ask that question, what would happen if you turn your attention towards that suffering and resolve that suffering? Could you do that before answering the question, what's the meaning of life? And is it possible to turn around and study that suffering and settle it? And once it's settled, what happens to the question? If the suffering that prompts you to ask the question is settled, then what happens to the question? So the analogy that is sometimes talked about that's related to this is, if you go to the plains of Africa to do nature photographer, you could run around the plains and to try to find all the animals, take pictures of them, and you exhaust yourself. An easier way is you sit by a watering hole and wait. And sooner or later, all animals in the plains of Africa, apparently, need to come to the watering hole to drink. So you sit there and wait and take pictures when they come. So the corollary here is that our suffering is that watering hole. And all the issues we need to deal with our life for the purposes of liberation, for the purposes of this very deep happiness and peace that is liberation, all the issues we have to address will come to us if we sit at the watering hole of suffering, if we pay attention to that, look at it. Suffering and happiness, stress and freedom from stress, tension and its release. And it might seem kind of mechanical and mechanistic, it might seem kind of reductionalistic to look at just suffering, just stress, and the freedom from it. It might seem kind of pessimistic and kind of party-pooping to look at that. But I think it's very realistic, and it really shows us what are the real issues we have to look at, rather than wasting our time with a lot of other things that maybe are just abstract. And rather than being pessimistic, rather than being kind of a downer, kind of bad news to look at suffering, the whole point is to be happier. The whole point is to find the path and how to live in a lighter, happier, fuller way. So hopefully, even though initially it might seem kind of, you know, kind of depressing to look at your suffering, hopefully very quickly it seems like a really great thing. Like, this is a good path. Hey, I'm getting lighter. You know, just, you know, things are getting happier. And I've heard stories of Buddhist teachers who, there was 3 15-year-olds who went to see Suzuki Roshi in 1965 or so, and they'd heard that he had a natural way of getting high, because back in San Francisco at that time there were unnatural ways of getting high. And so they heard this guy, the Zen master, can teach you how to get high without taking drugs. And so they asked him the question, and he said, oh great, come here. And he sat them down, and he proceeded to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There's a cause of suffering. There's the ending of suffering. There's the Eightfold Path. And, you know, they came to hear about getting high, not suffering. But the one woman I knew who was part of this little group, three girls, said, he was just so happy talking about suffering. That it got my attention, you know. She's been a Zen student ever since. Now it's been over 40 years. So the idea of self is a dead-end concept in the teachings of the Buddha. The idea of person is not. To have some concept of what it means to be a person, a human being, is not a dead-end concept. It's actually, you need to have one. And the Buddha has one. You might not agree with it, but he has one. there might be an overlap between trying to understand, you know, when we start to understand who we are, we understand ourselves as a person as opposed to a self. Does that make sense? No, it doesn't make sense? Oh, well. So, and one of the, in the teachings of the Buddha then, and that's what we're talking about today, one of the preeminent ways of attaining liberation, attaining happiness, attaining peace, is through meditation. And part of the reason for this is that the activity of selfing, the activity of clinging in the mind, and that stress and tension that comes from it, is very subtle. I mean, it's gross, it's obvious sometimes, but it also can be very, very subtle, very, very deeply, deeply entrenched in the mind, and difficult to see. And you need to get a mind which is very still, very, very peaceful, or I say it differently, you need to have a mind which is very, very peaceful in order to see the very roots of where the mind is not peaceful. So part of the reason why to push peace, become more and more peaceful, is that peace gives us a vantage point to see more deeply. It's like having a pond, right? A pond has waves that are choppy on it. You can't see down. But the clearer and more still the pond becomes, the more easily you can see to the depth of the pond. So meditation is one of the preeminent ways of creating the peace that can go really deep, or really pervasive, really big, so we can see down to the depths and the roots of who we are. And then, the last kind of view of the human person that I'll mention today, this tradition has, is that the tendencies inside of us that cause suffering and bondage and unhappiness, disintegration, have at their root, have certain roots that deep down in the human mind, there are like seeds, or the tradition calls it roots, mula, roots, and really deep down, from which sprout and proliferate the vast array of human tendencies that cause suffering. And the Buddha says there are certain plants, I don't know which ones, I think like a plantain plant maybe, or some certain plants in ancient India, that if you simply chop it off, cut it off at the trunk, it will resprout from the roots. But if you really want to get rid of this weed or this plant, you have to uproot it. So if you can do a lot of, a human being can do a lot of house cleaning, we can resolve a lot of issues. But if we're only doing it at some surface level, then, like I like to say, it's like rearranging a deck chair from the Titanic. Or it's, you know, it's just like taking care of certain things, but then these latent roots are still going to operate, and they're going to pop up another way, sooner or later. They're latent roots that are there. So part of the view of the human person in this early tradition is that there are these latent tendencies, these roots or these kind of deep seeds. Sometimes they can lay dormant for long, long periods of time. And that if you want to be fully liberated, attain the full capacity, fulfill our full potential and capacity for peace, we have to be able to drop down into the place in the psyche or the mind where these roots reside, so they can be seen once and for all and somehow be plucked or transformed or changed or something. So there is that. So this is my understanding, my attempt for you to give you some sense of what it means, what the Buddhist view is of what it means to be a human person. I hope that these last weeks have been more clarifying than confusing, and I hope that it gives you some better context understanding of when Buddhist teachers talk about anatta or not self or no self, kind of what it's about and how it fits into a bigger picture of what it means to be a human being from a Buddhist point of view. And I hope that you, at least in principle, have an increased appreciation for the value of the Four Noble Truths, as the value of why the Four Noble Truths are so central teachings in Buddhism, and the increased value of why it might be useful to look at our life from the filter or the viewpoint of the Four Noble Truths as opposed to other filters. And one of the advantages, if you do that, is that it makes the path of Buddhism lighter and lighter, easier and easier. Because if you focus on suffering and the freedom from suffering, then each step along the way, hopefully, is a releasing of tension, of stress, of the forces of suffering. So each step along the way is a step of making peace. And as you walk that path, hopefully each of us will become more and more peaceful in our own hearts. And I think one of the most beautiful things that I know in this human life is a heart which is at peace. It's incomparable in beauty and profundity and all kinds of things, purity. And it's one of the greatest gifts that anybody can give the world, is to give those gifts that help other people become free of suffering and also have some taste of our potential for peace and for this profound happiness. So, thank you for listening to all this. I'll see you in 2 weeks.